Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1291, Comcast Corporation Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Ms. Walker for the petitioner, Mr. Simons for the interveners, Mr. Schlick for the respondents, and Mr. Morey for the interveners.
Good morning, and may it please this court, Helgi Walker for petitioner Comcast Corporation. With the court's permission, I'd like to try to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In the order on review, the FCC found that Comcast violated federal internet policy. At the time the complaint in this enforcement proceeding was filed, there was not a single provision of federal law, no federal statute, no federal agency rule, no federal agency adjudicatory precedent, whether valid or not, that governed Comcast's network management practices. All that existed was a policy statement, and that is all the complaint alleged a violation of. In the policy statement, the FCC shared its insight into broadband and the internet and expressly disclaimed the adoption of any binding regulation. Under rudimentary administrative law principles, clearly established in this court's precedent, under cases such as Pacific Gas and Electric, that document quite simply lacked any legal force or effect. The FCC nonetheless enforced the policy statement against Comcast, finding our practices unlawful for failure to comply with its terms. Critically, the Commission in its brief has not argued to you that it made or enforced any law in this proceeding. To the contrary, the Commission has boldly embraced the rather remarkable proposition that it can and did enforce pure policy. But just weeks after filing its brief in this court taking that position, the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to establish the policy statement as law, recognizing, at least implicitly, the unenforceability of the policy statement standing alone.
I'm not sure that follows.
Can they issue rules if it's just if all they have is a policy statement?
They are in the process of attempting to do that, Judge Randolph, and we don't know, of course, how that proceeding will be resolved, and that is an issue that I suspect may well come before you in the future. But what is at issue in this case, the question presented here, is whether the Commission could sanction Comcast for violating nothing more than pure policy. Again, that is the position in their very own brief. Over and over they say they have authority to enforce policy and that that is what they did. I don't think that is a proposition that is remotely credible under this court's clear precedent regarding the legal status of policy statements. Well,
setting aside that argument, isn't the commission arguing? excuse me. Isn't the commission relying on its ancillary jurisdiction here?
Well, that's a different question. The question is, what did they actually purport to say that we violated? Whether they have statutory authority to create something is a different matter. What they argue,
even if you're right that they don't have authority to rely on 230B, even if you're right about that, couldn't the commission? Isn't it possible that the commission's order could stand on the basis of its ancillary jurisdiction if it could be linked to some statutory authority the commission has?
No, it could not, Judge.
Why is that?
And that is because while they might be able to adopt a prospective regulation, say in the new rulemaking, based on that theory of statutory authority act, we had no fair notice whatsoever of any rule or regulation or any provision of law that was applied to us.
We have many cases which say the commission can make policy in adjudications.
Correct, Judge Tatel, but that is always, always consistently against the backdrop of some statutory scheme that Congress has actually charged the agency with administering. So in Chenery, the prototypical case on this, the SEC was interpreting Section 7 and 11 of the Public Utilities Holding Company Act. There was at least some notice under those statutory provisions that the conduct at issue was regulated. We had absolutely no notice that our conduct was regulated, much less of the particular standards applied against the company in the order, Judge Tatel. For instance, the non-discrimination mandate sprang full-blown from the head of the order itself. So, too, the strict scrutiny standard that was applied, which the agency, by the way, has now disavowed.
What do you do with, Midwest Video One, CCIA, and Rural Telephone, they all relied on, commission all relied on policy. In all those cases, the commission relied on policy statements.
Well, actually, what the commission relied on, and our brief points this out with specific citations, were particular provisions of Title II, 205, and 201B that gives the commission direct statutory authority over the rates for common carrier services. And the commission's theory in those cases was that they had to regulate one area in order to effectuate their duty with respect to regulated rates. So enhanced
services. Right. Well, my point is this. If that's the case here, and I'm not saying it is, but if that was the case here, why would there be any notice problem or anything? In other words, wouldn't the commission be okay?
I don't think so,
why?
Judge Tatel, because in Trinity Broadcasting and also in General Electric, you wrote for the court that where a regulation is not sufficiently clear as to the particular standard that is applied to the parties at bar, it cannot be used for a finding of liability.
Right, but in GE, we also said, had EPA merely required GE to comply with its new interpretation, there wouldn't be a due process problem.
That's right, but you
and
went
that's,
on.
That's all that's happened here.
No, sir. You went on to say in GE mm-hmm. that the case would have ended here, but the EPA found a violation
right.
and imposed a fine. So to hear.
But they didn't impose a fine here.
Correct, but there was a finding of a violation against the company. And under cases like Strauss, where there was only a letter ruling by the FCC that said the radio company petitioner had violated the personal attack rule, that is more than enough.
But suppose there's no future consequences at all.
There are future consequences.
What are they?
Judge Tatel, we are subject to the assertion of continuing jurisdiction, which was an extraordinary move in the order. We are subject to that continuing jurisdiction over our network management practices today.
And there was a disclosure provision in the order, was there not, that you also were bound by, or am I?
Correct. We've complied with that,
of course. You complied with that, right.
Yes. But the assertion of continuing jurisdiction, if you had any doubt, Judge Tatel, exists even today. And no other broadband ISP is subject to that.
Wait, you mean, but only because if you violate, only because if you, that's only if you, if Comcast does the same thing again. There's no, is the commission?
Right, but that is an added regulatory burden under cases like Lutheran Church that clearly impose costs and compliance and other things upon us. But this court's cases make clear under Strauss and Meredith and indeed Gates and Fox, the lead due process case that the FCC itself cites, there was only the issuance of a citation by an OSHA inspector that the company had violated.
How about in Pacifica? FCC, you know what they did in Pacifica? The big sanction was the FCC put a letter in their file. That was it.
Right.
That was enough to trigger First Amendment scrutiny.
Right. And Judge Tatel, you explained in GE, citing Judge Edwards in the Rollins case, that the finding of a liability is itself a substantial sanction. Why? Because that can be the basis for increased forfeitures and other penalties against the commission in future FCC proceedings.
I understand that. In the brief, the commission says, that it, quote, did not penalize Comcast in any legally cognizable way.
That's incorrect under Gates and Fox, their
own
case.
Suppose when they stand up here, I ask them whether or not there's any future basis based on this order for increasing a forfeiture, and they say no. Doesn't that take care of the problem?
It's not a binding. Whatever they say in this court is not binding on them.
Suppose we then put it in our opinion.
Pardon me?
Suppose we then put it in our opinion.
I just don't think
that's pretty binding, isn't it?
Wouldn't that solve the problem? But
all right, we'll ask him.
Judge Tatel, truly, Gates and Fox involved the issuance of a citation. That was it. Strauss, a lead due process case, involved the issuance of a letter ruling, finding a violation, declining to impose a forfeiture, but saying, watch out, because we're going to actually consider this against you in the future. This court's cases are clear. Lutheran Church said the same thing. Meredith said the same thing over and over. That's been enough.
And you're a party aggrieved.
We are an object of the order on review, yeah. Judge Randolph. We are self-evidently injured under Sierra Club. Again, the finding of a violation under Meredith counts. We've also suffered reputational harm under cases like Southern Mutual. We suffered procedural injury under cases like City of Dania Beach. We incurred major costs of compliance to switch out our network management practices. In Chrysler, Judge Randolph, you were on the panel there. You said a product recall was more than enough to create a due process interest because Chrysler spent a lot of money to effectuate that recall. So too here, we spent
a
lot of money.
Recall here, though.
We don't have a recall, but the point is what you said is that Chrysler spent a large sum of money and that that was property within the meaning of the due process clause, so too here. But I don't need to stand on that. The finding of a violation is more than enough.
Change this. Is this the first attempt by the FCC? But let me back up. There, in looking this over, I found a good many situations in which Congress has instructed the FCC to study the Internet and taxation of transit sales transactions on the Internet, and this and that and the other thing. But what I don't find is any congressional directive to the FCC to regulate the Internet.
That's
is
right.
Is this the first occasion when the FCC has made that effort?
This is the first time that they have tried in any substantial way to exert authority over the Internet.
Directly
it's a historic case.
I mean, we have cases where the telephone hookup and so on and so forth, but this is a direct regulation.
It's direct regulation, and it's the first major attempt to do so.
Do you analogize the Internet service provider you've got Comcast, to the provider of CATV or cable television?
I'm sorry, we are a cable operator for some purposes.
I know that.
But in this context, we are a broadband ISP, and broadband ISPs have never been regulated. In fact, they've been
No. The reason I was asking is because the cable operators have some First Amendment rights, and I don't see that playing out in this case at all.
We've not asserted that because we think the administrative law principles are so abundantly clear that a policy statement, basically a piece of paper, cannot be enforced against a regulated entity, at least on a retroactive basis. Whether the commission has statutory authority to adopt rules in the future, whether the interpretation might be reasonable, you stress this, Judge Tatel, in your opinions going forward is a different question. But at least as to due process, the question is whether there was ascertainable certainty, and that is a strict standard. And given that there was no law at all, I just don't see how the commission can meet that standard.
Let me take you back to the ancillary jurisdiction. To the ancillary jurisdiction issue we were talking about. In Midwest Video 1 and CCIA and Rural Telephone and all these cases, the commission's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction over a service over which it didn't have direct authority was justified because of the implications for something it did have direct authority over, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, suppose in this case the commission could link its order here to, I'll just give you the example. In paragraph 16 of the order, the commission says that its order here promotes the goal of achieving reasonable cable charges because it says that it's consumers' ability to use this file sharing application could put downward pressure on cable rates.
That's an interesting theory, Judge Tatel. They abandoned that in their response brief in this court.
Uh-huh.
They abandoned the citations to the particular provisions that they cited in the order, and they came up with a new theory.
That's a good point. But set this just for purposes of discussion, so I can understand the theory.
Happy
here.
To do so.
If this statement were supported by evidence, okay, and not abandoned, wouldn't the case then be just like Midwest Video On and CCIA and these other cases?
Your Honor, if they had substantial evidence, substantial record evidence, and that is the language of Southwestern Cable
Correct. I
itself,
understand that.
And also in
That's why I said if.
In NARUC, you found a want of substantial record evidence to prove up the theory, that would be, a much closer case. But I respectfully submit.
Would it be closer on this issue, or would that just be closer on the ancillary authority question?
Oh, that, of course, is limited to ancillary authority.
You still would not be conceding that they can hold an adjudicatory hearing without some law to adjudicate.
Absolutely not. In fact, as we stressed in our reply brief, we actually think that statutory authority need not be reached in this case.
But if what they're adjudicating here is, let's stick with this provision in paragraph 16. If they're purporting to adjudicate cable rates, right? If they had evidence to support it, and if they hadn't abandoned it, all those ifs I give you, okay? But why couldn't they do that through an adjudication? Then it's just like Midwest Cable? Your Honor, it's just, then it's just like Midwest Video One and CCIA.
Back to fair notice. I think if they were going to try to stitch
but that's
together
no different
these...
than that's no different than Midwest Video One and CCIA.
Well, in Midwest Video One, I don't believe there was a question of any retroactive liability or civil liability. The commission announced rules for cable television and applied those prospectively. That's a fundamental difference between what we have here. But I would like to point out that in this court's cases,
of course, if you're right, excuse me, if you're right about this provision not being sufficient and there's nothing else there, that is, if there's no ancillary jurisdiction, then we don't have to get to your due process argument at all, right?
You need not get to ancillary jurisdiction. You can and you should resolve this case based on the well, clearly established principles of this circuit's precedent, the policy statements, and this is the language of Syncor. You were on the panel there, Judge Tatel. Do not bind the public.
Conversely, if we decide on ancillary jurisdiction, we don't necessarily have to decide that question.
Right. It's true. You would, I mean, though...
Is either one of them necessarily the antecedent question? This is not like subject matter jurisdiction.
I actually believe that the question of the unenforceability of the policy statement or the direct enforceability of 230B, which is the first argument in our brief, is logically antecedent. It is the narrowest question presented to you for decision. In Syncor, again, Judge Silberman, writing for the court with Judge Tatel joining, explained that it was prudent to take the APA argument regarding the status of the FDA notice first. Why? He explained that that was because statutory authority would presumably be considered in a subsequent rulemaking. Here, the court need not presume. We know that the FCC, in paragraphs 83 through 87 of the new NPRM that they issued after they filed their brief in this court, expressly tees up the question of statutory authority to adopt the principles as a policy statement. In USTA, Judge Silberman also explained that it was smart not to collaterally affect a pending rulemaking.
This whole idea of sometimes it's referred to as ancillary jurisdiction, sometimes ancillary authority. But are the Midwest Video One? There was no majority opinion for the Supreme Court, so we've got Midwest Video Two. Is that the only instance, other than the offhand statement in Brand X, that the Supreme Court has referred to this ancillary jurisdiction idea?
In my preparation for this case, I've not seen any other instance.
See, Midwest Video was decided in the 70s.
Midwest Video 1 was a plurality opinion with Chief Justice Berger providing the fifth vote and pointing out that this case strained the outer limits even of the doctrine. So I respectfully submit it was the high watermark. The court cut it back in Midwest Video 2 by saying you have to have a reference to Title II
in that case. Maybe I shouldn't comment on the merits, but I will. That it seems so out of step with contemporary Supreme Court jurisprudence. It reminds me of the old implied rights of action. Congress didn't do it, so we're going to make up something to fill this gap. And the Supreme Court has moved so far away from that kind of an analysis in today's modern jurisprudence, it seems antiquated.
I agree. And Brown and Williamson is an excellent example of that. There, Justice O'Connor said that if Congress had meant to delegate to the FDA jurisdiction over tobacco as a drug or device, it was reasonable to expect that they would have done it in not so cryptic a fashion. And she stressed that no matter how important, controversial, or conspicuous the issue or the agency's desire to regulate in the public interest, their action must always be grounded in a grant of authority from Congress. And in Southwestern Bell, this is very important, Judge Randolph, this court surveyed the landscape of law here and said that ancillary authority under this, although it's a vague doctrine, must always be tied back to either Titles II or III of the Act. That is binding circuit precedent. And by the way, it's a correct reading of the law up until that point. But yes, it is out of step with more modern cases like Brown and Williamson and Whitman, the elephant in the mouse hole doctrine that said on a question this important, on a question whether the FCC should regulate what it itself says is the most important communications development in our lifetimes, it's quite reasonable to expect that Congress would have said something about it. Here they've said nothing. To the extent they've said anything, Judge Randolph, they've suggested that a deregulatory approach is best. But to suggest that by stitching together policy provisions and on, that Congress spoke to this and intended.
We said much the same with FTC's attempt to regulate lawyers under the Graham-Briley
Right. And, of course, those weren't even
ancillary. We actually plagiarized the elephant and the mouse. So,
and those weren't even ancillary authority cases. And there you've said that you've divined a cautionary approach by the Supreme Court. But, again, this case doesn't stand or fall on statutory authority, although we think we have the far better of the arguments on that. It can and should be decided on the clearly established. It couldn't be more clearly established, with all due respect, Your Honors, that a policy statement does not have any legal force or effect. And we were sanctioned for past conduct, for violating that conduct,
and the
order cannot stand.
Let me just pursue this a little bit, particularly in view of Chief Judge Sentel's question about what is the antecedent question. He asked you whether you were saying we should decide this on the due process.
Actually, I think our brief says on the unenforceability of the policy statement, but I think fair notice is a substantial additional ground.
Okay, but let's assume we agree with you that the policy statement is no grant of authority to the commission, all right? That still leaves the question of whether there's ancillary authority connected to Title II or some other provision of the Communications Act. If there isn't, then why isn't that an equally sound basis for deciding the case?
With all due respect, Judge Tatel, yeah. Our position is not that the policy statement is authority for the commission. Our position is that the policy statement was not law.
You're misunderstanding my point. Maybe I asked the question the wrong way. Assuming we agree with you about that.
Right.
Okay? And find no basis for ancillary authority in any other way. Why can't a decision rest on that as well?
We would be happy to take a ruling in our favor on statutory authority in addition.
I'm not saying I agree with that. I didn't quite understand why
se.
You thought we couldn't go that way.
You certainly can, but candor requires me to tell this court that in, for instance, Syncor, USTA, and CropLife, you have said.
Well, why do we need to say that again? We've said it
first.
So many times.
Pardon me?
Why do we need to say it again? We've said it so many times.
Well, you've said it so well, Judge Tatel, that.
I definitely don't need to say
that. Well, it's just consistent with the court's general approach, of course, of not deciding questions unnecessarily. And you can resolve this entire controversy on this clear ground and give us all the relief we seek by vacating the order. And by the way, I would just like to get out that they've not contested that that is the appropriate remedy. You can free us of this black mark on our record. You can free us of continuing
jurisdiction. Wait, who hasn't contested?
We can free you. We have freed you of your time. Unless
yes, I just want to know who hasn't contested what?
The FCC has not contested our assertion that vacator is the appropriate remedy in this
case.
Oh,
I see.
What the
Sorry.
Remedy is.
Yeah,
they're
I
not
you.
Conceding that she should win, but I if she wins, they concede that that's the remedy appropriate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. We'll likely give you back a minute or two for rebuttal. We'll hear from the intervener. I mean, not that you necessarily need it or want it, but we'll see at the time.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Howard Simons for Interveners National Cable and Telecommunications Association and NBC Universal in support of Comcast. In my short time here, I'd just like to make two points. First, the order is unlawful because it subjects the entire industry now to a vague, unformed, legally binding set of standards with respect to network management and the operation of their broadband networks that did not exist before. Contrary to the teachings of this court in Trinity Broadcasting and General Electric, the order provides no sufficiently clear guidance, no adequate certainty to enable broadband providers like members of NCTA to determine what conduct is proscribed and what conduct is permitted. While the order does permit reasonable network management, even there it offers no guidance for assessing what reasonable network management is. The fact that the FCC has now issued a rulemaking asking how the very same principles given the force of law in the order should be applied and enforced proves the point that there currently is not sufficient guidance.
I'm not sure that follows. There's a Shakespearean expression we borrowed in other cases that sometimes one needs to make surety sure. The fact that they are seeking clarifying regulations does not mean that they're conceding that they do not have authority to act without the regulations, does it? I'm not asking you to concede your case, but that particular logic is not compelling, is it?
I think it goes, Chief Judge Sentel, I think it goes to the question of whether or not what's out there now provides the kind of guidance this court has told administrative agencies they need to provide.
Since they know that they're under attack on that score, the fact that they're seeking to make it certain that they have such authority does not imply a concession that no authority exists now, does it?
I'm certain the FCC would say they're not conceding that, but I think if you...
I'm not seeing the logic of that proposition.
I bring it up to support the point, which I think is clear on the face of the order itself. You don't need to impute motive to the notice of proposed rulemaking. You only need to look at the order itself, which, contrary to assertions at the FCC and its interveners, applies not just to Comcast, but on the face of the order, applies to all providers. If you look at the order throughout, it talks about rules and standards that are applied to everyone, not just to Comcast. And that puts all of NCTA's members in the impossible position of making costly decisions about network management without knowing if they're guessing correctly. And now, unlike prior to the order...
Well, you're always in that position because you're at the beck and call of Congress.
That's true.
And that's the missing element nobody's quite mentioned yet. But there is an argument that to allow the FCC to aggregate to itself the power to decide whether the Internet should be regulated and how, it allows Congress to evade its responsibilities.
And Judge Randolph, to that point, as we point out in our brief, Congress has repeatedly seen bills introduced and reintroduced on this very point by very senior members of the chamber, both chambers, and not having had those bills enacted.
The only bills that get passed are ones that say study it.
Study it or don't regulate it.
I guess we've used your time up as well.
You have, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Walker hasn't attempted to defend the actual network practices that were employed here, and so I won't spend time.
Well, her position is that she doesn't have to.
Correct. And, Your Honor?
Yeah, would it not be rather an implicit concession on her part if she were to try to defend those practices? She's here to say that you don't have any business inquiring into those practices. Ergo, we don't either. Ergo, if she were to get up and try to defend them, that would be sort of giving her case away, wouldn't
it? That's exactly their position, Chief Judge Sentell. And right. Ms. Walker's assertion...
You may want to move on to something that's an issue.
That's precisely what I'd like to do, Your Honor.
All right, please.
Ms. Walker's assertion this is some sort of unprecedented regulation of the Internet is just profoundly ahistorical. The Internet service and access here...
It's an unprecedented attempt, she would argue, to decide by adjudication a regulatory issue when there is no background to adjudicate. I think that's what she's saying is unprecedented.
That's one of the things she's saying. She's saying two things. First, that the Commission has never and cannot regulate in this area. That's her answer.
I don't understand that to be her argument.
I do, Your Honor, and I believe there's a second argument, which is that the Commission can't make policy through adjudication. Both are incorrect. And let me begin with the first, Your Honor. Internet
Do
access
either of
service,
my colleagues think that she is arguing that the FCC cannot regulate the Internet?
I am not sure about that.
Okay. Maybe you should go ahead with that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You don't need to argue that as far as I don't find that in her argument.
Let me just explain, and it does go to ancillary jurisdiction, regardless of whether she's clearly making that argument or not. Internet access service.
Is it ancillary jurisdiction or is it ancillary authority?
The Supreme Court has said ancillary jurisdiction. This court has used the expression ancillary jurisdiction. The thrust of the matter is the Commission's authority to take actions, including adjudicatory
actions.
The Commission
has jurisdiction over all interstate wire and radio communication, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So where's the ancillary part of that?
The phrase ancillary jurisdiction has been used to describe the Commission's power to take actions that are necessary to effectuate the congressional purposes embodied in the Act, as opposed
to So it's ancillary to the, power, which is another way of saying we don't really have the power, but it's ancillary to something else that we do have the power to do.
The Supreme Court...
Right? And we said that in American...
No, Your Honor.
We said that in American Library, didn't we?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. What the Supreme Court said... going back as far as the NBC case and then particularly in Southwestern Cable, is that the Commission was given by Congress the power to effectuate the broad purposes of the Act and is not limited to effectuating its specific detailed mandates.
You know, now, let me stop you. All questions of government are questions of ends and means, right? The problem that you have is all that Congress has spoken about here is the end. It is our policy that the Internet shall remain free and competitive and so on and so forth. But the real difficulty in legislation and getting legislation passed deals with the means. And it's not only how far do we go, what other considerations and do we compromise along the way, and all of that. None of that has been done here by Congress, right?
No, not right, Your Honor.
What statutes has Congress enacted that make the sort of means type judgments that I've just mentioned with respect to the Internet?
Congress has not told us how to do it, but Congress in the 1996 Act, which includes Section 230B and 706, has given the Commission.
706 is not a grant of authority to the Commission.
With respect, Judge Randolph, in the Ad Hoc Telecom Users Committee case, this Court held just this year, that Section 706 provides a mandate to the Commission, and this is at page 906. Section 706 instructs the FCC to facilitate broadband deployment and mandates actions to remove barriers to broadband investment. Page 906 of that decision.
What if you...
Give me that slide again, please.
Yes, Your Honor. That's 572F3rd at 906.
What if you, if someone said that as a matter of policy, interpreting Section 706 as an independent grant of authority would be an error? What if somebody said that?
That was the Commission's position before.
I just read a Commission decision.
Correct.
That has not been overruled.
No, and let me explain that.
It goes on for page after page explaining why the statute you're relying on doesn't give the Commission any authority to do anything but encourage. It's aspirational. It's not operational.
No, Your Honor. What the Commission said in that decision is that it is not itself an independent grant of authority, and that was before it was codified. Section 706 has now been codified. It was in 2008, shortly after the decision at issue here. But at the time when it was an uncodified provision, the Commission held
The Commission's decision did not rest on the fact that it was uncodified.
It was uncodified at that point.
The Commission, of course, didn't anticipate that
it would become codified. My point is that the Commission was saying that this is a mandate from Congress against which we exercise our delegated authority. And the Supreme Court said in the Southwestern Cable case that Section 2A of the Act provides the Commission the authority that it needs to effectuate the broad purposes of the Act.
That's the jurisdictional provision.
No, but yes, it is. And I do.
I'm not getting an answer. I want to get an answer. The Commission said 706 is not an independent grant of authority. You cannot regulate on the basis of 706. What you can do is you can regulate on the basis of other provisions and take 706 as an encouragement, right? Now, I asked you the question, go back. I asked you, what independent authority did the Commission have to regulate the Internet? And the only thing you've given me is 706, a provision the Commission says doesn't give them that authority. What other provisions do you have?
Your Honor, I'd like to give you the historical answer and then the case law answer, if I may.
I'd like the statutory answer, not the case law.
Sorry, Section 2A, as interpreted by the United States.
Well, all that does is say you have jurisdiction.
To implement the purposes of the Act. And the purposes of the Act are the ones cited by...
Let me give you an analogy. If we get a case, and the case is Bell v. Hood. Are you familiar with Bell v. Hood in the Supreme Court? Okay. The fact that we have jurisdiction, and we have jurisdiction over cases arising under the Constitution, doesn't mean that there's a cause of action. All that means is that you have to have some operational law to apply. The fact that we have jurisdiction doesn't give us the operational law to apply. All right. What's the difference? You have jurisdiction, but where is the statute that you're implementing with that jurisdiction?
Judge Randolph, I would ask the Court's indulgence to explain why Ms. Walker's argument is incorrect as a matter of statutory interpretation, Your Honor, the sections of the Act are the ones cited in the order in our brief. That's Section 1, and I understand that the Court has concerns about Section 1. That's Section 230B.
That's just a policy statement. Yeah.
That's Section 706, which
and that has been interpreted does, and that, by it. And that doesn't give you independent authority. What else do you have?
We have Title 6 of the Act, which is the cable regulation. And contrary to Ms. Walker's assertion, we did not waive that. Page 44 of our brief, Your Honor, says exactly what Judge Tatel was asking his question. And Ms. Walker said that we had waived it. It's page 44 of our brief.
These are the provisions that Ms. Walker referred to in the reply brief as saying you haven't mentioned them?
This is the page of our brief where we talk about the Commission's rate regulation function under Title 6 of the Act with regard to cable services. And it's we cite paragraph 16 of the order, the same paragraph that Judge Tatel just cited.
Page 44?
Yes, Your Honor. The third line, authority over cable modem services is likewise ancillary to the Commission's oversight of cable television services under Title 6. And we go on to cite paragraph 16 of the order on review.
The problem with paragraph 16 is that there's no evidence to support what the Commission said there. There's no citations to the record.
It's
just a statement that the action here was necessary to protect cable rates, but we don't know. I mean, we have no idea how many people are using this particular file sharing system. We don't know anything about its consequences. It's just a statement in the order.
That, Your Honor, would be an arbitrary and capricious challenge that that cable Comcast
made. I don't think so, because the question here is there statutory authority for what the Commission has done? And the reason I asked counsel about that is that it seemed to me that sentence, that finding, was at least linked to the Commission's authority over cable rates. And if it's just a statement that without any authority, then it can't be a basis for invoking that part of the Commission's statutory authority. That's why I asked the question.
The record, if the Court is interested, we could provide citations to the record.
You have to rely on the brief you've got.
And your opinion.
This is not an argument that was made by Comcast. So, of course,
no,
we didn't
but let me.
To it.
No. I think it is. I actually think it is, because I see the issue about paragraph 16 as relating to the Commission's statutory authority. And that argument is made by Comcast. Mm-hmm. Comcast argues that there's no statutory basis for the Commission's action here. Let me ask you, if I could, about Southwest Cable, which you mentioned a couple times.
Yes.
In Southwest Cable, the Court said there that that the practice that the FCC had regulated in that case threatened the system of local broadcasting created by Congress and the Commission under its licensing authority. And that's what the Commission was talking about, or the Supreme Court was talking about when it referred to the Commission's broad responsibility. In other words, in this case, the reason the Commission, this is the way I read the case, the reason the Commission justified the reason the Court accepted the Commission's regulation there was because it was linked to the need to protect the broadcast licensing system over which the Commission did have authority. That's what Southwest Cable says.
That's correct, but that is not the only permissible exercise of ancillary jurisdiction. And I'm going to make one more plea to the Court to go through the case law to explain how the Supreme Court, including in recently Judge Randolph, not only the Brand X case, which is directly controlling on this point,
which case,
but
sorry?
Also in
you
the AT&T
that one
versus
Iowa. No,
line no.
At the end of the paragraph.
No, Your Honor. In three places, pages 976, 996, and 1002. The Court thrice rejects the argument that if the Commission decided in its regulatory role to classify Internet access service, broadband Internet access service, as an information service and to take it out of Title II, and here I'm going to make my historical point, that from the first day of the Internet until 2005, this service, internet access, was regulated pervasively as common carriage service. And what the commission did is make a policy decision to lift regulatory weight off of this service. And the argument was made at that time by our intervener, Free Press, and by the states that if the commission chose to do that, it would lose regulatory power. And the Supreme Court thrice said in that opinion, no, that is not the truth, that if the commission is upheld in regulating its information service, it will nevertheless retain the power that it needs to ensure that those specific regulatory obligations that it deems necessary are imposed.
Like, and that's what? Like what?
In this case, like preventing a network operating practice that, although supposedly designed to prevent congestion, was not in fact targeted to
what
congestion.
What statute governs that?
The Communications Act and the 1996 Act. And
just the policy. Your Honor, it's a policy.
Yes, and now I will ask to explain why that is amply sufficient. First, Ms. Walker claims that the Commission's ancillary jurisdiction is limited, and that's their word. This is their reply brief, pages 21 to 22. It is limited by Section 4I of the Act. 4I of the Act is a grant of authority, and it's a grant of authority that in the statute it is broader than Ms. Walker acknowledges the Commission has under the statute and the broad case law. So Section 4I says the Commission may perform any and all acts, make such rules and regulations, and issue such orders not inconsistent with this Act as may be necessary in the execution of its functions. Broadly, its functions, not specific provisions of this Act, but its functions. And Ms. Walker says that the Commission's jurisdiction is actually narrower than Section 4I alone says. But the Supreme Court went beyond 4I, and it said in the Southwest Cable case that the Commission has under Section 2A the power to undertake acts that are reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of its various responsibilities.
Yes, and in that case, the responsibility related to the protection of the broadcast licensing system over which it does have plenary authority.
Yes, they did, Your Honor, and the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine has been applied much more broadly
than
that,
example.
Including
in where? Which case?
Let me give you some cases of this court. New York State Commission case, New York State Commission on Cable TV, 749 F. 2nd at 808, which recognized the court's, the commission's jurisdiction over satellite master antenna television service, which is a type of cable service to multiple dwelling units. And the basis for that jurisdiction was the promotion of the commission's general federal interest in unfettered development of satellite services. There's no section of the Act that
you
directs
seem to be arguing that 4I gives the commission all the authority it needs to do anything. Why do we have all these other statutes that give the commission specific authorities to do things?
No, I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. I'm arguing that 4I is the bare minimum of the commission's authority, and the Supreme Court, in fact, has recognized a broader authority than that, as has this court. In
How is that different than what I just accused you of? You're saying that 4I gives you the authority to do anything you need to carry out the goals of the Communications Act.
No, Your Honor, let me respond to that by citing the cases that disprove
Don't
that.
Respond to that by citing the cases. Tell me yes or no whether that's what you're asserting.
No, because the restrictions.
All right, so it is restricted. So 4I is restricted, right?
4I is restricted. And
so what's the limiting principle if it's not what Ms. Helge Walker suggests, that you get the authority to act to regulate where the Act says you can regulate, that you don't get an unbridled roving commission to go about doing good?
The restrictions are the requirements of ancillary jurisdiction, which have been vigorously enforced by this court and others. Principally, the first requirement that the matter must be within the commission's jurisdiction. In the MPAA case, this court said that we lacked jurisdiction.
Which case?
A motion picture. It was the case in which the commission asserted authority to require program description. And the court said that that is outside the commission's ancillary jurisdiction because the commission, as a general matter, does not have the power to regulate content. Likewise, in the American Libraries case, the commission asserted jurisdiction to require particular technology inside televisions. And the court said no.
But that's because it violated, that failed the first element of the
Correct.
And not the second element.
The second element is the Midwest Video case, second Midwest Video case, where the court said that the commission lacked authority to require public access channels, the same channels that Congress later required, because that was inconsistent with Title II, which established a common carriage regime, and cable operators have not been subjected to that.
I'm confused by your argument. And I just want to be clear about this. On the one hand, I hear you saying that the commission has the authority directly to enforce the policy statements in 203B and 706A. Have you said that?
No, I haven't meant to. If I did, it would...
Well, I thought you were saying, yes, the commission can enforce them, And then, have another argument that you kind of fall back on, and you keep repeating, ancillary jurisdiction. So I'm not clear where the ancillary part comes in here.
Yeah. The ancillary jurisdiction gives the commission the power to effectuate congressional purposes, even in matters that Congress hasn't yet specifically addressed. And that was exactly the design of the act, as explained by the NBC court, the Supreme Court, 319 U.S.
Say that again. It gives ancillary jurisdiction, under your view, gives an agency, the commission, the authority to effectuate policies that Congress hasn't addressed.
Haven't specifically addressed. It allows Congress to affect.
How do you square that with Midwest Video 2?
Let me explain. This was exactly the argument made by Justice Murphy in dissent in the NBC case. He said that the commission can only act where it has a clear mandate at page 233 of that decision. And the majority at pages 218 to 220 said just the opposite.
Did you hear my question?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. Oh. And the answer to your question is that the Supreme Court has recognized that congressional intent is furthered by recognizing the commission's power to implement congressional policies as stated in the act, even with respect to matters that Congress has not specifically addressed. And it did that because of new technologies. This is the core of the commission's mission.
Whether I read Midwest 2 correctly or not, I think it is correct, our court has held in American Library that what Midwest Video 2 stands for is that the ancillary authority has to be pegged to a particular operative statute. And that's why I asked you the questions that I began this dialogue with you. If 706 is a specific grant of authority for the commission to regulate, you don't need ancillary jurisdiction. If 203B is, you don't need ancillary jurisdiction. But neither one of them is, both of them are policy statements, and you have yet to identify a specific statute that gives you authority that your authority here is ancillary to. And that's what American Library's interpretation of Midwest Video 2 is.
Your Honor, and I'm going to move off this point after just citing three more cases that are contrary to that view of the law. This court's decision in CCIA, which specifically recognized the commission's power to implement Section 1 of the Act, NARUC 880.
Well, before you go through them, let me respond to you, okay? CCIA, in CCIA, we expressly relied on commission findings that the action there was necessary to protect telephone rates. Title 2.
Yes, the commission specifically disclaimed reliance on Title II.
No.
And this goes to Judge Randolph's question.
We relied specifically on that in Comcast, in CCIA.
In CCIA, the commission said we are not, and this Judge Randolph is your question.
What did the court?
The commission, which is the background for the court's decision, said we do not do this under Title II. We do it pursuant to Southwestern Cable and Title I to effectuate the purposes of Title II. And this court upheld that. Likewise, in the
Let's not go off CCIA yet, okay? We said it was in CCIA that the regulation there was, quote, necessary to assure wire communication services at reasonable rates.
And in paragraph 16 of this order.
But let's set that aside. You and I can, you've heard my views about that. I don't see any support for it there. And you were about to go on to NARUC, right?
Yes.
Okay. NARUC.
One of the NARUC cases. This is the 880F second NARUC case.
Well.
Is that the same one?
I don't know. The NARUC case I want to talk about is the one where the commission was attempting to extend its jurisdiction to an early version of broadband.
Talking now about the inside wiring case.
Let's talk about this NARUC case, okay?
All right.
right? You know the case.
The 533 F second. Is that the?
I don't have the site here. This is the one where they were, where the commission was trying to regulate cable modem service, right?
No, that was traditional cable service. That was back in 1976, before cable modem.
All right, wait.
It was traditional cable service, and what?
I'm talking about the 1976 case.
Yes, before cable modem service. Cable modem was late 80s, 1990 approximately.
They were trying to regulate two-way point-to-point video communications, i.e. cable modem, right? That's what it was.
It was cable.
It was cable.
Yes, cable. Cable TV.
No.
As opposed to cable internet.
No, I don't think so. It was.
This is 1976.
It was the use of leased access channels.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, leased access. And
and we talk about having in our decision in Nehruk, invalidating that, computers speaking to each other. That's the way we referred to it.
Yeah, it was using cable capacity,
exactly.
not for consumers to access anything like
the
internet.
But my point about this is this. To me, the commission made the same argument there that it's making here. It said there, remember, it was preempting that state regulation of that service. And it said that it relied on Section 1 to support that preemption, which we rejected. And we rejected it by saying cable jurisdiction is incidental to and dependent upon specifically delegated authority under the Act. And in this case, we said it's difficult to see how any action the Commission might take concerning two-way cable communications could have as its primary purpose the furtherance of any broadcast function. So, and this case is totally different because, as far as I can tell, except for the one paragraph you and I have been talking about in paragraph 16, every justification I've seen for this is an internet justification, not a cable justification.
If I may respond first,
focus on this case.
First, this case. Pages 607 and 615 explain. You're correct that the commission's action was not upheld, but the framework that this court applied was entirely consistent with my argument here. What the court said is that Southwestern Cable, the Supreme Court, requires balancing of the statutory purposes served by ancillary jurisdiction against those impaired, and now at page 615, and allows the FCC to advance the purposes pursued by the substantive titles of the Act. And again,
I agree. I see your point. I mean, Midwest Video One. I mean, Midwest Video One is your best case, right? For that.
It has direct language, yes.
Yeah, but in Nehruk, we explained Midwest. Well, no, forget that. Never mind.
It's American Library.
Yeah.
We explain.
Let's go back to my point about Nehruk. Explain to me once more why in Nehruk, Commission was arguing that these Supreme Court cases gave it plenary authority over cable. We rejected that. Mm-hmm. And we rejected it because we said, as we later said in American Library, it has to be linked to express statutory authority. That is the ancillary authority.
No, I think you said it has to be consistent with the purposes of the sections that the commission cites. And let me come back. Judge Randolph, you suggest this was an ancient doctrine and that there were
no
recent cases.
I just want to comment. I think Judge Tatel correctly stated the holding in American Law.
And I'd ask the court, the AT&T against Iowa Utilities Board case, very recent case, 1999, 525 U.S. at page 380, explained what ancillary jurisdiction is in exactly the same terms that I'm applying here, and that is ancillary jurisdiction gives the commission power, quote, where the Act does not apply.
Is it your bottom line position that Congress can give an agency, an independent agency, authority, jurisdiction over a vast area, and then pass a statute that says, well, let's just take not an independent agency, but take EPA. Congress gives EPA jurisdiction over the entire industry of the United States. That's Clause 1 of the Section 1. Section 2, it is the policy of the United States to have clean air. Section 3, EPA shall enforce this statute. That's constitutional in your view.
I think it would be construed to be constitutional by inferring into Section 3 within the limits of its jurisdiction, and that's precisely the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine. Now, I spent a lot of time on this. I'm going to ask the court to let me address first a point. That
Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up.
I do have two.
Just listen to Judge Tatel.
Two more questions, and one of them may take you to what you want to get to. But I want to understand what the limits, whether there are any limits to the argument you're making here. If the commission can assert jurisdiction to make Comcast service more, quote, rapid and efficient, which is what it did here, could it also regulate the rates of that service to be sure they're available at reasonable rates?
It would have to draw a very close connection between that action and the specific statutory purposes served.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that it would need.
I don't understand that.
I mean that it would need to establish, because this is an area which, unlike internet,
except for paragraph 16, where has it done that in this case?
Well, it hasn't. It hasn't attempted to regulate the rates, so it hasn't. It hasn't made that showing.
Yeah.
But
you say it could regulate cable rates.
Theoretically, it's theoretically possible if necessary. And of course it can do that, because the commission, if denied this authority, can, in its discretion pursuant to Brand X, and Brand X is clear that the commission has a jurisdiction, determine that as a matter of policy to effectuate these policies, it's necessary to consider that it's a Title II service, which would subject the service directly to rate regulation. So there's no question that this service is within our power. The question is, are we allowed to apply this light regulatory touch that we are, or do we have to go to the heavier approach?
So if the commission... The commission justified its order here because it, quote, maximizes user control over what information is received by individuals, right? Families, et cetera, who use the internet.
That was one of the bases, yes.
So could it regulate search engines and email?
No, because...
Why not? It fits right under that.
No, because email is content, which under this court's cases...
No, it doesn't regulate the content of it. It regulates the amount of it.
You mean how much email an individual
To control to control bandwidth?
This court surely would hold, or whatever court asked to review it, would say that the act doesn't give us the power to regulate.
What about social networking websites?
The use of those sites by individuals?
Sure.
No.
Why not? Because it directly quote maximizes the user control over what information is received.
Right.
By individuals, families, and people who use the internet.
Because this court has told us that our exercise of ancillary jurisdiction must be within the scope of the communications subject to our jurisdiction.
We may have put a limit there, but aside from the limit we put on, does your argument have that limit in it? What you're arguing for would say our limits were wrong, wouldn't it?
I don't intend to argue that.
Where do I find any of these limits you're talking about in the commission's order? I mean, you've just given me a couple, but where do I see them in the order?
You don't need to, because what the commission did here was require Comcast to live up to its word. Comcast said it would stop. It said it wanted to adopt a practice that was more consistent with the health of the internet and with consumer safeguarding. And the commission said, "Do that." That was the full extent of the quote regulation, close quote here, to require Comcast to do what it said it would do.
But your theory on upholding that action is unbounded,
right.
And that's the that's one of the problems with your presentation. And you've been asked now by two of my colleagues to tell us where the limits are, and I don't hear it being said. What's
on review here is not my theory, but rather what the commission did. This argument is, of course, it's stopped under New Hampshire against Maine. Ms. Walker claims that they didn't take an inconsistent position below. I'd refer exhibit.
Yeah, but how did that do any harm to the commission?
It did harm.
It's an equitable doctrine.
It did harm to the parties who were seeking recovery in the Northern District of California, whose recovery was delayed.
Let me ask you a totally different question. Just to pick up on something I mentioned to Ms. Walker, and it's this question about the implications for Comcast of this order in the future.
Yes.
They're worried that it could be used as a basis for a higher forfeiture in the future.
Yes.
How can I read this language in the brief? You say it did not penalize Comcast in any legally cognizable way. Does that mean that this order cannot be used by the commission in the future to for an enhanced forfeiture of any kind?
It does not mean that. That would be permissible under Section 1.80 of our rules, 47 CFR. Okay. What it means is that the commission did not do that, and there has been no sanction sufficient to trigger due process in this case. All the
we
cases
can take it as a concession that this could be used to enhance penalties in the future.
And yes, Your Honor, and okay, if no, this
then,
court
then
believes that
you,
that would create a due process
of, haven't
problem.
Haven't you conceded her point about the due process argument?
No.
I don't understand why, because under GE and the other cases, there are future consequences to Comcast.
GE was a $25,000 fine. The cases recognize two types of severe sanctions sufficient mm-hmm. to trigger the constitutional interest in life, liberty, and property, and those are either a fine or denial of a license. Those are property interests. There's nothing like that here. Ms. Walker, for the first time at argument, is saying, oh, we had compliance costs. The compliance costs were doing what Comcast said it wanted to do. We didn't impose any kind of compliance
costs. Did they want
to
do that before the order?
Yes. They said they wanted to do it.
Why'd you have the hearing?
They said they wanted to do it after we developed the evidence, which they then conceded was correct. But before the order, the argument that we were enforcing a policy statement is incorrect. The Adelphia order, 2006, before the order, directly tells Comcast what it would be exposed to if it engaged in this blocking practice. The Adelphia order said three things. First, the commission has jurisdiction over internet access. Second, the policy statement will be used to assess Comcast's conduct. And three, if in the future evidence arises that Comcast is willfully blocking or degrading internet content, affected parties may file a complaint with the commission. The Adelphia order directed specifically to Comcast.
All it said could happen was somebody could complain to the commission. It doesn't say the commission could adjudicate and take action which would have the future consequence of enhancing forfeiture in the future, right? It did not say that, did it?
I think it's fairly implicit, saying okay. We will enforce the policy statement.
So we're going to what's implicit again. The commission seems to be intent upon acting upon implicits in this litigation, does it not?
No,
you're
not
very much explicit to
no,
go on here.
I would simply say that, as Ms. Walker pointed out, the commission has a rulemaking to address these broader questions about which the court has been asking.
Right.
The action
if we,
in this
if
case.
We, if you lose here today, you've still got your rulemaking, right?
I don't think we do.
You're deciding or fearing that if we decide you don't have ancillary jurisdiction, that could be used to upset the rulemaking? Is that?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
That's your theorizing now. So if you're going to lose, would you rather lose on the other ground that?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said that we have jurisdiction to regulate cable modem internet access service. We take refuge in the Supreme Court's recent decision. Of course, if I'm going to lose, I would like to lose more narrowly, but I above all want guidance from this court so that when we do this rulemaking, if we decide rules are appropriate, we'd like to know what we need to do to establish jurisdiction.
We don't give guidance. We decide cases.
And we take those cases as guidance in our
There was a time in the circuit several decades ago when they were in the business of giving guidance to agencies. And there was a case that you may be familiar with called Vermont Yankee that said we shouldn't do that.
The guidance we would take is from the holding in response to the two issues that Ms. Walker has raised here. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the intervener.
May it please the court, I'm Marvin Amore. I represent the interveners in support of the FCC. The interveners include consumer groups like Consumers Union and Free Press and technology companies, some of whom use peer-to-peer technologies to serve millions of people, including Skype and Views. And I'd like to raise two issues that are unique to the interveners, one having to do with jurisdiction, one having to do with process. And on the administration, on the jurisdictional issue, it was my clients that raised the argument in Brand X that if the FCC moved to a Title I world for broadband access services, the FCC would lack jurisdiction to stop cable companies should they, and I quote, exclude certain services if the company does not want them delivered for any reason. And then Brand X, the Supreme Court, six justices held, the commission remains free to impose these obligations. And then the FCC asserted repeatedly that it had the jurisdiction to act if there were a violation of blocking or degrading of content. And the FCC asserted that it would use that jurisdiction through adjudication or through rulemaking. And it was my clients who, in the Adelphi order, urged for a condition on Comcast that Comcast be subject to a condition to not block any content, video, or voice services. And the FCC held that, referred to its policy statement. So the statement contains principles against which the conduct of Comcast, Time Warner, and other service providers can be measured, and then held that if future evidence arises that any company is willfully blocking or degrading internet content, affected parties may file a complaint with the commission. And that goes to notice. Our clients brought evidence to the commission.
Doesn't there still have to be some sort of regulation or law to adjudicate in order to do this by adjudication as opposed to rulemaking?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll suggest that if the FCC loses, they lose on jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Please. We've been debating this for 6 years, and the future of broadband regulation and communications regulation rests on the jurisdiction of the FCC to act, and it should be resolved here. It's been fully briefed. So in terms of the jurisdiction of the FCC to act, this strikes is not very different from Southwestern Cable, maybe an old case, et cetera, but it's very similar. In Southwestern Cable, the FCC asserted five different sort of obligations and policies to promote, UHF, educational TV, a whole bunch of different policies. And then the order there was to stop a cable company from providing service to an area. And it's hard to jump from those services and that ancillary jurisdiction all the way to that specific order. There, the FCC had a rule in between. Here, the FCC had a policy statement providing tons of notice. But it's still no different. You begin with the jurisdictional question, and if there's ancillary jurisdiction, then the FCC has, under Chenery II, the ability to choose adjudication or rulemaking. And the FCC told the world over and over, we will use adjudication.
You have a case where there was actually nothing to adjudicate but a policy statement.
Where there's nothing to...
Here the FCC has nothing as the background for adjudication
except
a policy statement.
Yeah, yes, Your
Do you
Honor.
Have another case in which that's been the only case, either with the FCC or any commission?
So the way it usually works, Your Honor, is there will be...
Never mind the way it usually works. I asked you a question. It doesn't seem that counsel at this table understand that the three people get to vote on this, and you should speak to the subjects that the voters are interested in. And the one this voter is interested in right now is, do you have a case in which the commission has held an adjudication and been upheld, in which there was no background law except a policy statement?
Yes, Your Honor. The case cited by the FCC is CBS v. FCC. It's a 1980 case before this circuit.
You have the citation on that?
I do, Your Honor. It is 629 F. Second 1. And ancillary jurisdiction has been exercised in adjudications.
Were you saying earlier that I didn't understand your point about Southwestern Cable. Is your point that Southwestern Cable supports the commission here?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, well, I'll ask you the same question I asked FCC counsel, which is, in the Southwestern Cable opinion, the court pointed out that the regulation there was justified because it threatened the system of local broadcasting created by Congress and the commission through its licensing authority.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it linked the exercise of authority there to the commission's authority over broadcasting,
mm-hmm,
and the licensing system it created. And now, where do you see that same connection here?
So, Your Honor, in the order below, the FCC relied on several provisions, including several in Title II, such as 201 and 256 in paragraph 17 and 19. In the briefs here, the FCC is focused on 706, as imposing an obligation.
Suppose 706 doesn't work for the commission.
Well, the FCC has also relied heavily on 230.
Well, suppose that doesn't work because it's a policy statement.
I can make an argument that the FCC didn't rely on heavily in the briefing, but
well,
that's
briefing.
In the order. So in the order, the FCC relied on 201 and 256 and 251, and I can explain that to you since it hasn't been briefed.
Not argued here anymore.
That's what I said.
Okay, so... So let me go back to my question. All right, if 706 and 230 don't work, then where's the analogy in this case to the Southwestern Cable connection to a statutory authority over which that the commission has? Where is it?
Your Honor, it's harder to find, but if you look at the policies that were in Southwestern Cable, it's hard to describe those as pure responsibilities that are very specific. The responsibilities are there, which were...
I was just reading you...
I've got them in front of me.
I'm reading you from what the court says. Yeah. This is not amorphous. Mm-hmm. It's talking about the commission's authority over broadcasting through its licensing. And then it says... that's what it's talking about. The commission has been charged with broad responsibility for the orderly development of local TV. Mm-hmm. There's nothing vague about that. In Southwestern Cable, the court rested its holding in Southwestern Cable over the commission's authority over cable, but over the consequences of cable on the commission's over broadcast licensing. That's the connection that I see in that case.
Yes, Your Honor. And the FCC makes a Title VI argument to that effect, and whether or not the court buys that argument, that's the argument I was asking about? I think so, because you're saying that in Southwestern Cable, the regulation of cable turned on authority over regulating broadcast.
Exactly.
Right. So here the FCC is saying the authority to regulate broadband internet service rests in part on their ability to regulate cable.
Cable, and the question I asked counsel is, where is the evidence that supports that? There's just a statement in the order that says that, but I didn't see any evidentiary support for it.
The FCC had a long hearing, and the FCC determined that issue, that there was there's a potential competitive effect and price reduction effect.
All right, I'm finished.
All right. I want to ask you about that CBS case you cited. Wasn't that a rather specific adjudication under the Campaign Communications Reform Act?
It was, but it applied to broadcast networks.
Yeah, but the question I had asked you was there a case in which the FCC had adjudicated without a background statute or regulation?
Your Honor,
you gave me CBS, which I don't think cited in any of the briefs, but that was not such a case, was it?
That was adjudication under ancillary jurisdiction. And
no, that wasn't the question. The question was, can you cite a case where the only thing that was done is the FCC enforcing policy? That was
where there was an adjudication used for nothing other than the enforcement of a policy statement. And that CBS case involved a statute, the Campaign Communications Reform Act, didn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I raised it to your attention as a case that applied an adjudication answer your jurisdiction.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, then your time is up, and we'll hear it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Walker, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
CBS involved Section 312A7. There was a complaint filed in that matter alleging a violation of that particular statutory provision. I won't spend time on the basic proposition, which I think the Court understands, that regulation under the ancillary authority doctrine can't be a means unto itself. It has to be a means unto some regulated end. I think Judge Tatel put that well. We are not arguing, Chief Judge Sentell, that the FCC lacks any authority to act in this area. All we're arguing, all we could argue under Article 3, is that this order fails the ancillary authority test.
If we hold that the ancillary authority is not there, does that obviate the ongoing regulatory
I think it will have collateral effects on the rulemaking, and we'll be back there arguing about what your opinion means in all candor.
Oh, it'll be person clear.
But your point, Ms. Walker, your point, I take it, then, I'm glad that this was brought up. Your point, then, is not that the commission has no authority.
No,
over
Your Honor.
The internet. Your point is that any exercise of authority has to be linked to an exercise of statutory authority under the Act.
Exactly.
Right?
Correct.
That's your point. And as you and I discussed, if, for example, paragraph 16 was supported by adequate evidence, right, that's the kind of thing that might provide a basis for regulation. Right?
We are arguing that this order fails the ancillary authority for the reasons you mentioned, Judge Tatel.
Okay.
But can I clarify paragraph 16? Because this is important.
Right.
The argument is waived, Judge Tatel, regarding cable rates. The order cited section 601.4. That is a purpose provision in the Cable Act. In their brief, they relied on section...
Wait, it's a what?
It's a purpose provision in the Cable Act. The cable provisions are adopted for this purpose. Uh-huh. In the brief, the commission relies on Section 543, which gives them authority over cable rates. So the 6014 argument they did not bring up, and 543 was never mentioned in the order, so it is barred with all due respect, Your Honor. American Libraries used the language statutorily mandated responsibility. That is a direct quote. They did not mention purpose. Judge Adolf, you are right that Judge Tatel correctly stated the holding in that case.
We now have come past the end of your rebuttal time, and unless my colleagues have further questions, the case will be submitted.
Thank you.
Given the state of the courtroom, my guess is that many of the people in the courtroom now are not going to be interested.